You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Bob Spitz returns to the show this week. He's the author of many fine books, including Deary, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child, Reagan, An American Journey, The Beatles, The Biography, to name but a few. His latest book is Led Zeppelin, The Biography. Bob Spitz, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
What an eclectic array of books you've written.
Yeah, try to draw a straight line through them. It's pretty difficult.
Yeah, usually biographers, their works kind of overlap in some way, but Julia Child, Reagan, Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, really. Well, you know, listen, I'll tell you, you can draw a straight line through them. I try to write books that have two qualities. Number one is the subject has to be beloved. And secondly, they have to have changed the culture in some way. And there are so few people who come under those two categories that I think, you know, if you look at Julia Child, certainly the Beatles, Ronald Reagan, too, whether you voted for him or not. And the same with Led Zeppelin. I mean, are they beloved to some people? Have they changed the culture? Yes, quite well, they have.
Well, I had an argument, so to speak, with about a 30-year-old friend of mine who said, well, you know, Led Zeppelin was the greatest rock and roll band in the world. And I said, well, no. The Beatles are clearly the greatest rock and roll band in history. And he goes, well, the Beatles, they're... You know, see, he was trying to argue that the Beatles weren't a rock and roll band and that Led Zeppelin was. And I was thinking about all the... I can't help but compare the Beatles and Led Zeppelin, especially because you've written about both of them. And the fact that you could go right now into a crowd of people, well, although you're not supposed to without your mask, but you go into a crowd of people and say, tell me the names of any of the members of Led Zeppelin. And ask that same crowd, tell me the names of any of the Beatles. And pretty much everybody can tell you the names of the Beatles, and they might be able to tell you the name of a Led Zeppelin, but probably not.
Well, you know, of course, the Beatles are internationally known. I mean, Paul McCartney is probably the most recognizable face in the world right now. You could make that that argument. But the truth of the matter is, my next book is going to be about the best rock and roll band in the world. And I will tell you that I'm now the Rolling Stones biographer.
Oh, fantastic.
So there goes your argument, Gary.
Beatles versus Stones. We'll do Beatles versus Stones next time, Bob.
Yeah, of course.
But of course, you pointed out in your book that even during Led Zeppelin, their bass player, John Paul Jones, could just walk through a crowd and nobody would recognize him, even though he was in the biggest rock band in the world.
Yeah, he was a chameleon, to say the least. And, you know, he had one of those vanilla faces that could take him anywhere, and people wouldn't be able to pick him out. Plus, he changed his hairstyle so often, his look so often. I think your argument holds. You know, will people recognize Robert Plant or Jimmy Page? I don't know. That's a tough one.
Before we get into the meat of Led Zeppelin, I want to ask you about the Peter Jackson film, The Beatles Get Back. Have you seen it? And did you find revelations in it that changed the way you thought?
I wish I could say I did, but you know, it's funny, when I was researching the Beatles biography, they showed me a lot of that footage. The canon, Abbey Road. And I had the luxury of being able to take a look at that and knew what was there when I wrote the end of the book. But nevertheless, I think it stands, what Peter Jackson did, stands as a remarkable artifact that just gives us a final look at the Beatles in a way we've kind of imagined they'd be, but that we've never seen before. And here we are, you know, 50, 60 years later, and the Beatles are still the subjects of everyone's fascination. And it's great to see them like that. I think it's really wonderful for young kids too, who have heard about the Beatles, but never had a chance to see them. Here they are.
Yeah. You know, some people have said to me, gosh, I wish they had done film like that on every single one of their albums. Wouldn't it be great to see them doing Sgt. Pepper? Right. And I said, you should read Bob Spitz's book, The Beatles.
Great. You're not going to get royalty out of this, Gary. Sorry.
Well, now you did after your Beatles book, which is such a marvelous, wonderful book, you did a sort of a kid's version of that book called Yeah. And I wonder, will there be a kid's Led Zeppelin book? I don't think so.
No. This is an X-rated version. I'm sorry. There's no way to really tame this story. And I didn't realize until I got into it that exactly what kind of a story I was writing.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking again in my constant comparisons of the two groups, Beatles and Led Zeppelin, the key difference, I think, is Brian Epstein versus Peter Grant. I mean, if they had had a manager who had been anything like Brian Epstein, the experience would have been radically different.
Yes, exactly. You know, the Beatles always, I mean, when Brian died, and I won't use the language on your show, but John basically said, we're finished, in using different words. And he was right. He was right, because Brian Epstein was the anchor. Every band has to have a manager who anchors them down so that they can be they can behave like artists, they can do their work, they can even go off the rails a bit. But if you have a manager who is the anchor of the whole machine, then that's going to survive and hum along. Not so with Led Zeppelin. Peter Grant, you know, Peter Grant, let's face it, he was a London thug. You know, he grew up with the Cray brothers. He behaved like the Cray brothers. And he became a cocaine addict very early on in the process of Led Zeppelin, and it destroyed him. He behaved like a child, and the band, you know, had no anchor, and that's exactly the case. And that was a very good perception on your part.
He also had no class. I mean, Epstein had a lot of class. And Peter Grant,
Brian had class. Peter had Peter Grant had class. In his own way, he was kind of what you'd call a lovable rogue. You know, the record companies loved dealing with him because they were of the same species. And you know, they understood each other. Also, Peter protected Led Zeppelin in ways that other bands hadn't been protected. He made sure they got paid when bands weren't being paid by promoters and were being hustled. And he was always at their side. He attended every show they ever did. But, you know, the behavior of the band was pretty bad. And Peter's behavior was pretty bad as well. And so that collapsed as the train kept rolling.
The other night I saw this new documentary about Charlie Chaplin, and it's quite good. And it makes an issue of the fact that Charlie Chaplin was essentially a pedophile, that two of his brides were 15 years old or something when he married them, and that he was always attracted to young girls. And even after Michael Jackson's death, there has been a lot of talk about Michael Jackson being inappropriate with young people, and there was a major 3-hour television special about that. And yet Jimmy Page is alive and well. And he hasn't actually been like Me Too'd in the way you might think he would be. I mean, it wasn't just that he had groupies. I mean, like, sure, every rock and roll group has groupies. I'm sure the Beatles did too, although they didn't make as big a deal out of it. But his groupies were young, like middle school.
And earlier and younger. Yes, look, the Beastie Boys said it best. If I could play guitar, I'd be Jimmy Page. The girls I like are underage. And indeed they were 14 and in some cases 12. Wow. It gave me enormous pause writing about it. And in fact, I did speak to a lot of those young women, girls, excuse me, at the time. I can't even call them young women. My wife warned me away from that because they were, you know, not just underage, they were not even adolescent. I mean, you know. But he's gotten a pass. Yes, rock and rollers have gotten a pass more or less. Jerry Lee Lewis paid the price, of course. Bill Wyman had difficulties. But for the most case, rock and rollers in the Me Too years have gotten a pass. And
I mean, even recently, people like Ryan Adams and people like that in the music industry have been pulled down by it. So it's odd.
Yeah, Jimmy is up there on a pedestal that they haven't been able to yank down yet, like Robert E. Lee. But you know, interestingly enough, the Beatles did have groupies, and they had girlfriends, and all their girlfriends were age appropriate, always throughout
even,
the entire
even to this day. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, even to this day, exactly right. So are there comparisons to be made? Yeah, of course there are. And Led Zeppelin is the dark side of the moon.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Welcome back to the show. I'm Gary Shapiro. This week we're talking with Bob Spitz. He's written many great biographies, including Dearie, the story of Julia Child, The Beatles, the biography, Ronald Reagan, An American Journey, and his new book is called Led Zeppelin, the biography.
Bob Spitz, you've not only written about rock and roll, including Woodstock and Bob Dylan, but you know, you've lived rock and roll. You love rock and roll. Yeah. So do I. I've been to a lot of concerts. I'm going to say that a person like you probably did drugs in your lifetime. Maybe not you personally, but someone like you. Have you ever felt the urge when you're staying in a hotel to throw the television out the window or to smash and destroy?
You know, for your listeners who don't know, I was on the road with Bruce Springsteen and Elton John for years. I was really charmed being with two guys who behaved like they should behave. Bruce throwing a something out the window, hardly. He wouldn't throw a hamburger wrapper out the car window. So, I mean, you know, and Elton was a complete gentleman, complete. However, let me say that I came to understand what Led Zeppelin was doing. Having been on the road and understanding the bubble that you're in and the pressure that mounts up, traveling from city to city to city every day. You know, Bruce and Elton went out for short stretches at a time. Led Zeppelin was basically on the road for 10 years. Those guys rarely got home. They were in a different hotel every night, being dragged to the airport on a plane, eating terrible food, not always, but most of the time in hotel rooms, never really having friends. And in Led Zeppelin's case, they weren't even friends, the four guys. You know, with the Beatles, there's so many comparisons to be made. But with the Beatles, even at the end, when they were suing each other, if they went anywhere, they didn't take four separate hotel rooms. They took a suite. They all stayed together because they loved
each other. Beatles.
They really did. They continued to go on vacations with each other, even when lawsuits were flying. Not so with Led Zeppelin. In fact, I don't think those guys shared a meal together the whole time they were together. They liked each other enough, but they weren't friends. And so when you're on the road every day with no kind of honest stimulation, you act out. And these were, look, let's face it, these were young guys who had just grown up in rock and roll, never knew anything else, and they acted out. They acted out in the worst possible ways.
Well, I don't want to dwell on all that, even though it's a fascinating aspect of your book. And it's also something that weaves itself throughout their story. But let's talk a little bit about the music. And I have a question about it. This band was Jimmy Page's band, and Jimmy Page had this enormous conceptual idea of what a band should be and what he wanted to do with music. And yet at the end, in the post Led Zeppelin decades, Robert Plant has thrived. I mean, he has a brand new album out right now that's fantastic. And yet Jimmy Page has done virtually nothing. I mean, he did a couple things. But why do you think he hasn't done more?
Robert has evolved as a person as well, and has really sought new avenues of music. And as you said, Jimmy is still living the Led Zeppelin legacy. He's making sure that the brand stays in the public eye. He's just doing remaster after remaster, and occasionally he'll sit in with somebody. But, you know, Robert is a real gregarious guy. He loves people. He was one of the few members of Led Zeppelin that talked to the press, that engaged with fans. Jimmy never did. I mean, if you know, I've spent some time with Paul McCartney and with Keith Richards. And if you encountered those guys on the street, they'd stop. They'd take a selfie with you. You know, Keith would take his skull ring off and let you try it on and take a picture. If you tried to approach Jimmy Page on the street, you might have your arm broken. And so, you know, Jimmy has lived this bubble life. As you know from reading the book, he was involved in the occult. He's an incredibly talented, talented man. But he's a strange man, too. So, you know, Robert was very bright. He went to grammar school in the UK. He was accepted to colleges. He would have gone that route. And so the evolution is different. Jimmy never finished school. You know, he went to art college, which is where all the great musicians came out of in the UK. And hopefully we'll get to that later. But never really evolved as a person. And so that, I think, to answer your question, Gary, is the difference with the two guys. Jimmy is still caught in the past.
It also seems, in reading your book, that the critical reception of the Led Zeppelin albums, I guess there's 8 or 9 of them,
yeah,
was wrong on both sides. I mean, they got bad reviews from their early albums, and their later albums, the people who loved them gave them bad reviews, and I think their later albums were, so I mean, I think they did really interesting records all the way through that never found a critical appreciation in their lifetimes.
Yes, I agree, and I got to tell you, I was one of those people. I have 20,000 albums at home, vinyl, yeah, albums. I don't have a single Led Zeppelin record. You know, I was on the road with Bruce and Elton, and our paths didn't cross. I didn't know their music, and I kind of wrote them off as, you know, loud, heavy metal, headbanging, stuff that I didn't feel was refined. Boy, was I wrong. I mean, I've spent the last 5 years learning how wrong I was. But besides the fact, when they first started recording, it was really, they put a period at the end of the 60s, and their music ushered in the 70s. And all those critics who were writing at the time were critics from the 60s, and they were protecting their turf. They loved, you know, they came up with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Kinks and the Who, and then gravitated to Crosby, Stills and Nash and Joni Mitchell and James Taylor and Carole King. And so this loud music, they felt, was kids' music, you know, and, you know, they were right, because there was another generation coming up behind them, and each generation deserves their own music. And so, I mean, I can't say this any other way. Those critics were old farts.
Yeah.
And they were not going to give Led Zeppelin their due. And in fact, you know, Rolling Stone panned them, Crawdaddy panned them, all the major, the Village Voice panned them, all the major critics at the time wrote them off. And that really burned Led Zeppelin's craw. They did not take to critics at all, and in fact it really hurt them for the rest of their career, because they wouldn't have anything to do with the press. They thought the press was a two-headed beast, and they weren't going to serve that beast. But and towards the end, you're right, the kids wanted Whole Lot of Love and Stairway to Heaven, and they weren't getting that on those later albums. You know, Jimmy Page may not have evolved as a person, but his music was evolving, and so was Robert's lyrics. Robert grew up in Led Zeppelin. He was a 20-year-old kid. You know, at the end, he was a 29-year-old man and had learned his craft. And so they went in a direction that the fans didn't really understand. And you're right. So they got burned at the beginning. They got burned at the end.
I think like All My Love, which is from their last released studio album, I think that's one of the greatest songs they ever did.
Yeah, absolutely. Without a doubt. And, you know, things like Cashmere, a masterpiece, which the kids thought, you know, gosh, this is like Middle Eastern music. I mean, you know, it's for me, it's up there with their finest work.
Oh, I think 10 Years Gone also is one of their. Yeah, I think it's just so outstanding. So even a hip guy like you, Bob Spitz, I know you're a big BTS fan. You missed the boat on Led Zeppelin when they were originally around. Did you ever see them in concert?
I never saw them. No, but you know, I had never seen the Beatles either. So, I'm sorry that I missed them, because one thing that I've learned about Led Zeppelin is you don't just hear their music. You have to feel it as well. And I've talked to so many people who said that the concert experience was incredible when they showed up on time and there wasn't violence, because you know, your entire body, the music rattled your bones. And that's one of the great things about rock and roll, you know, that it doesn't just affect your ears, it affects your whole being.
Well, Bob Spitz, in your new book, Led Zeppelin, the biography, you take us to the floor of many of their concerts, surrounded by gyrating 16-year-old boys. it's interesting how they could be bad. I mean, one night when they wouldn't be very good, but it didn't make a difference to the audience whether they were good or bad. The audience was not critical of their performance.
Not at all. No. I mean, there were nights that they were just terrible. I mean, few, but they were there, and they got a free pass. I mean, the kids, it was a whole experience for these young kids. There were their gods, and you know, they were the golden gods, and they could do no wrong. And so the kids just fed off that whole the whole Led Zeppelin experience. It was quite an amazing kind of concert to be in.
And for a while, like maybe 30 years after, every 16-year-old boy had to go through their Led Zeppelin phase after they were gone.
You bet. And that takes me back to what I said at the very beginning, that they changed the culture. They changed the culture of rock and roll, and also the culture of teenagers, quite different from the 60s teenagers to the 70s teenagers. And a lot of it had to do with the type of drug.
Mm. And also, there was a difference in gender, in terms of the gender that loved them. I mean, that is, the Beatles were loved by both boys and girls. I know, because I was a boy and I loved them. But of course, there were a lot of screaming girls, and they were famous for that. Although we screamed, the boys screamed too. There was much more of a male fan base for Led Zeppelin.
Well, I think one of the reasons is that the Beatles were romantics. I mean, you know, look at their early songs. Please, please me. I want to hold your hand. You know, love me do. Really, I mean, you know, those were messages to
squeeze my lemon until the juice runs down my.
Well, yeah, there you go. I mean, you know, that's the message to a 15-year-old boy, and so you can see the difference right there. So they were playing. The Beatles played to girls, even though that the boys heard it and got the payoff. But Led Zeppelin really played to the animal in a 15-year-old boy and an adolescent. And that's part of the aggression that was so obvious in the 70s as things changed.
Their early years are interesting, and you spend a really lovely time in the first quarter of the book telling us about all of the great records that Jimmy Page played on. So many of our favorite pop tunes from the 60s, Donovan and the Kinks. And I mean, it's hard to find a record from England that doesn't have Jimmy Page playing on.
Right. And yet, you know, he played on What's New Pussycat for Tom Jones and Goldfinger for Shirley Bassey. I mean, Jimmy was the quintessential studio musician. And he worked like mad. This is where he really learned how to his craft, where he became, he could play anything. And John Paul Jones, too. They were, you know, colleagues in the studio. They often played on three sessions a day, 18 sessions a week. And they were working around the clock. It was a wonderful thing to write about. And also, you know, at the beginning of the book, it's the birth of rock and roll in the UK. I mean, and we watch it evolve so incredibly from the electric blues that we missed here in the States completely, the blues movement that the Yardbirds and the Rolling Stones picked up, and then Led Zeppelin morphed into a different sound later on, which was fun to write about. I really enjoyed that whole part of the book.
And there was a band that once had Eric Clapton in it, then Jimmy Page in it, and Jeff Beck in it. Isn't that incredible? Right. One band had all those three great guitarists in it.
Unbelievable. The Yardbirds, yes. And so I spent a lot of time talking about the Yardbirds and really how much they brought to rock and roll in the UK, and then how we got it here in the States as well. The Yardbirds is one of the greatest incubators of all. And, you know, it's funny, Gary, you mentioned that they had three of the greatest guitarists. The incredible thing, even more so than that they were in the Yardbirds, was the fact that they grew up as 14-year-old boys within 5 minutes of each other's homes.
Wow.
With Glyn Johns, also one of the great producers, right there as well. I mean, in one small little town in the UK. Fantastic.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. We're getting back now to our interview with Bob Spitz. He has written many great biographies, including what I think is the definitive Beatles biography called The Beatles, The Biography. He also wrote Dearie, The Life of Julia Child, Reagan, An American Journey, a great book about Ronald Reagan, and his new book, Led Zeppelin, The Biography.
I was watching The Beatles Get Back with Glenn Johns in it. And when I was reading the story about how Glenn Johns basically tells Jimmy Page to take off, a great story, which people can read in this wonderful book, Led Zeppelin, The Biography. I also found myself digging in and listening to a lot of music that I had either forgotten about or missed from that era, because it came up in your story, Spirit, and there were so many British bands that I hadn't paid that much attention to. And they're great. They're great.
Yeah, so many great groups came out of the UK during those years.
You should make a soundtrack album to go along with this thing.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. It would be great. But, you know, it was
partially James Harvest.
You could name them forever. And offshoots of the Yardbirds and the Stones and the Who and the Kinks, and Jimi Hendrix appears in the book as well as a kind of a character, with Terry Reid, another great voice. Terry Reid was supposed to be the lead singer of Led Zeppelin. Jimmy wanted him. That was his guy. And Terry couldn't do it and referred this kid he had heard, who was singing up at a teacher's training college in the boonies in the Midlands. And you know, that was Robert. So it's really a kind of a lovely story about the way it all matted together.
They'll go over like a lead balloon.
Exactly right. That came from Keith Moon when they were making, by the way, what I consider to be one of the quintessential turning points of music in rock and roll in the 60s. And that was Jeff Beck's album, Truth. I really rank Truth up there with Revolver, the Beatles' Revolver, as being the two albums that changed rock and roll into rock music. Gave it a different sound, experimented, and let the music grow up. And I think if readers get anything apart from Led Zeppelin's music in my book, I want them to go back and listen to Truth, because that's where Led Zeppelin came from, not the Yardbirds. It was from Jeff Beck's band.
Interesting. Very interesting. speaking of Keith Moon, when Keith Moon died, the Who continued. They got Kenny Jones from Faces and kept going. Why did Led Zeppelin not replace John Bonham and keep going?
Well, for one thing, Robert wouldn't go on anymore. His son had died. His wife and his kids had been injured terribly in an accident. His wife was actually declared dead and then managed to come back to life again from the accident. And Robert, at the end, when his mate, one of his longtime buddies, John Bonham, dies, I think Robert just goes to pieces and has to reevaluate his entire life. And he, not only that, he watched Jimmy Page and John Bonham lapse into drug addiction, where Robert managed to turn his life around and actually renounce doing anything, any drug anymore. And so, you know, I think he had just reached the end of his road with this band. Ostensibly, they put out a press release, and I'm sure they felt this was true, that they couldn't go on without their mate, John Bonham. It was an incredible blow to the band. They really loved Bonzo. But I think also they had come to the end of the road. Robert just couldn't do it anymore. He didn't want to be part of it, and he didn't want to work with Jimmy Page anymore.
So there may not have been a Led Zeppelin in the 1980s, no matter what.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, Robert, he didn't even want to sing Stairway to Heaven again. He just said, I'm never singing that damn song again. And, and he didn't want to. And if you saw the Kennedy Center honors, which was kind of lovely, with the three surviving members listening to these fabulous bands pay them tribute, Jimmy and John Paul Jones are really excited each time an act came on. Robert is kind of staring into his hand, neither looking pleased or displeased, but just he's there out of obligation, maybe, to the president of the United States. And I think that sums it up in a nutshell. He didn't want to appear with these guys. I will tell you, I've talked to a lot of people who are close to him in the last couple months. He can't even get the words Jimmy Page out of his mouth anymore. He calls him my former colleague, my former bandmate, but he won't say his name.
But Jimmy Page is still waiting for Robert Plant's call to put the band back together.
Yeah, they've tried. You know, Carmine Appice, who was a buddy of mine, who was the Vanilla Fudge's drummer, told me that they talked to him at one point. And I know they talked to Ainsley Dunbar and a few other drummers about taking over. But Robert and John Paul wanted to do it, but Robert would just never take the bait.
I talked to Richie Furay on this show once, and Richie Furay, founding member of the Buffalo Springfield. And he said when the Buffalo Springfield were founded, it was Stephen Stills' band. But now, if there were ever to be a Buffalo Springfield, it would definitely be Neil Young's band. When they did their brief reunion, it was Neil Young's band.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of happened with Led Zeppelin. That is, it was Jimmy Page's band, but if it ever went forward, it would be because Robert Plant said, okay.
I think that's exactly the truth. Although Jimmy would still be recognized as the leader of the band. It was always Jimmy's band, just as the Beatles was always John's band. And John was so miffed because it became Paul's band. It really did. And that's, you're right. That's a very good observation. That's what happened with Led Zeppelin as well.
In Get Back, Paul, you know, acknowledges to John, it's your band.
Right.
You're the leader. Yeah.
Right. But it, you know, we all know what happened there.
It's pretty amazing to look back at what they did. And they also made a film, not a very good film. Although a few years ago, Jimmy Page put out a DVD of live performances that's spectacular. But what went wrong with their movie? Why is their movie, The Song Remains the Same, such a terrible thing?
Well, I can sum it up in one word. Ego. Yeah. Wild egos running wild. I mean, it was, first of all, they wanted to control everything. They never really gave the filmmakers the reins to make a film. Peter wanted to control it. Then Jimmy wanted to control it. Then Robert wanted to control it, you know, and it became a mess. There were too many hands in the pie. Another problem, and it's pretty well documented in my book, is that they never really had good concert footage. They had just a few minutes. They didn't even have one whole take of Whole Lot of Love that they could put into that film. So they had to kill time. And what they did was they came up with a kind of diversion, and that would be each member of the band assumes a different personality. And that was a mess. It was a god-awful mess. In fact, I think it's the only time the New York Post had a star system. You know, you could have five stars or three stars or really one star if the movie was bad. But it's the only time they gave a movie no stars. I'd never seen that before.
So, yeah. Bob Spitz, when you were researching this book, and I'm assuming you worked on it a long time because it's very well researched. Who did you talk to?
Well, you know, I was supposed to talk to all four of the guys. They were, excuse me, all three of the surviving members.
Yeah.
But as the research rolled out, Me Too hit, and their lawyers told them not to talk to anybody. They were really nervous about it. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to talk to the guys, but I found 70, 80 hours of interviews that they had done that had never been seen before. And so then, of course, I talked to everyone around them, everyone who was available, a couple hundred people who were there, who were eyewitnesses, who could put you, the reader, in the room, as not just that they were on the road, but while they were rehearsing, while they were cutting their albums, while they were on their tour buses, while they were in their hotel rooms. And you know, that's what you have to do as a biographer. When I realized that I wasn't going to get to talk to the guys, I was despondent. And my wife came into the room one time shortly after that, and I was reading a book, and she said, "What are you reading?" And I said, "Well, it's David McCulloch's John Adams." And she looked at me and she said, "Did he interview John Adams?" And I looked at her and she said, "Get to work."
She's very wise.
Yeah. So, I miss having talked to the guys. I wish they would have participated. They would have added quite a bit. But, you know, I was lucky. I found Jimmy Page's next door neighbor growing up who gave him all of the albums that he learned from and taught him about blues and took him to meet a lot of the people and get his first guitar and knew his parents and was there when Jeff Beck knocked on the door as a 15-year-old. I feel like I made up for the lost cause that I was suffering from.
And you mentioned that you talked to some of these women who were the underage girl groupies.
Now in their 60s.
Yeah. So did any of them have regrets? Did they? One of them you mentioned that her mother basically groomed her.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. No regrets across the board. The young women felt like they were. These women felt like there was something special in their lives being associated with this band. I mean, it's a whole different mindset that I'd never encountered before. And it befuddled me. You know, I'm the father of a daughter. I mean, this was horrifying behavior to me. The whole groupie movement kind of persists even today, and so these were the pioneers. Boy, I hate to even say that, but and you're right, in some cases their mothers groomed them, and one of the women said, you know, her daughter was 14 years old when Jimmy would pick her up at their house and take her to stay overnight in the hotel. And she said, well, you know, Elvis is with Priscilla. I guess my daughter is with Jimmy Page. And really crazy kind of thinking.
Really, really crazy. Yeah. And it's also interesting that although drugs play a huge role in the history of rock and roll are responsible for so many rock and roll deaths, it was really alcohol that was the most destructive drug for John Bonham.
Yeah, and he was dabbling in heroin at the time too. You know, it was both. But, you know, one of the interesting things is in the 60s, the drug was marijuana. And so, you know, you were kind of, it was a laid back drug. You were, you know, you were mellowed into the music. There was no aggressive behavior at the concerts. Everybody was kind of blissed out. Not so in the 70s. The drug of choice was, in rock and roll, it was a cocaine experience in the 70s. And you hear it in the music. It's aggressive. It's all aggression. And unfortunately, cocaine often leads to harder drugs. And in the case of Jimmy and Bonzo and Peter Grant and Richard Cole, who was the road manager, heroin prevailed and eventually destroyed the band, I think.
Now, they did do their famous reunion concert, I guess it was a few years ago now, at the O2.
A few years ago for guys like you and me, Gary.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
kind of an era ago.
A decade ago or more, I guess.
Yeah.
they did sound pretty good, though.
They sounded great. Yeah. I mean, Robert deigned to do it because it honored Ahmet Erdogan, who was the founder and president of Atlantic Records, the record company. And at his death, they honored him this way. And they sounded terrific. And Jason Bonham really had his dad's licks down. He listened long and hard, and he knew from where he came. But they, you know, they had gotten together once before at Live Aid, and it did not.
Oh, that, no, that wasn't so good.
Yeah, that was a disaster. So.
Well, and the Atlantic Records thing, that was pretty interesting that they didn't want to be on ATCO. They wanted to be on Atlantic.
Right. Well, you know, it's the meat and potatoes of the music business. That's where everybody was. It was the label of Ray Charles and, you know, Etta James. And I mean, you know, Aretha, God, I mean, those guys idolized it, and they wanted to be one of the first white acts. Unfortunately, the Young Rascals were the first white act to be on it. But that was kind of their goal, to be on Atlantic Records. And they did it. Yeah, they broke through the color barrier.
It's really a fascinating story. And we've just, you know, touched upon it, what you uncovered in this really exhaustive and extremely well-written book. I really enjoyed the journey. Led Zeppelin, the biography, and the author Bob Spitz. When will we see the Rolling Stones, Bob?
Did my agent put you up to this?
No, I want to know. I want to know.
Research for me is usually 2.5 years. Everyone is cooperating this time out. It's going to be great. And Bill Wyman is one of the world's greatest archivists. He has every piece of paper that ever crossed their eyes. Wow. So I think about 2.5 years to 2 years to research, maybe 2.5 years to write. Stick around. Don't go away.
Well, I'll be looking forward to reading it and talking to you then. Bob Spitz, thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Gary, this is always a pleasure. My pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.